back to the Podcast for Happiness series. I'm your host, Guy, and I've been podcasting for over 3 years on a variety of subjects covering the big questions. And the most significant question for me is, what is true happiness and how can we achieve it? So throughout this series, I'll be speaking with thought leaders on this subject, journalists, authors, scientists, to help guide us on this journey. The science on this is constantly evolving, and the research is forever coming up with new ideas and concepts on happiness. So check out the Action for Happiness website, actionforhappiness.org, for more details about the great work that they're doing. Find out more about the events they're hosting, notably the big one in September, September 21st, where His Holiness, the Dalai Lama, will be speaking at this event. You can also visit their donation page there and help support this amazing charity. My guest today is Dr. Danny Penman, a feature writer for the Daily Mail, has worked for the BBC, New Scientist and the Independent newspaper, holds a PhD in biochemistry and specialises in reporting on science, health, the environment, and winner of the best book in popular medicine at the British Medical Association's Book Awards in 2014. And last year I was fortunate enough to get my first interview podcast with Danny. So Danny, thank you very much for joining us again on the podcast.
That's great to be back.
So if you Google mindfulness, best books on mindfulness, top five books on mindfulness, you'll find one of Danny's books on this list. Just the other day I was in Waterstones on Oxford Street, in between the self-help section and the spirituality. And Danny, I saw several of your books there, not only laid out on the tables, but also spread out on the shelves with the cover, you know, full blast showing. Mindfulness is becoming a huge subject and I just see it almost everywhere now. So perhaps we can begin by you telling our listeners, what is mindfulness?
Well, at its simplest level, mindfulness is just paying full conscious attention to whatever is happening at the present moment. So that's the thoughts and feelings flowing through your mind, or, you know, the sounds that surround you, the feeling of your body, you know, taste, smells, that kind of thing. And traditionally, this state of lucid awareness was cultivated through mindfulness meditation. And the simplest mindfulness meditation of all is, it's very simple. It is sitting down, it is closing your eyes and focusing on the sensations the breath makes as it flows into and out of your body. And over a period of minutes, sometimes longer, it creates this sense of heightened lucid awareness, and it actually really grounds you in the present moment so that you're less troubled by difficult memories from the past or worries about the future. And gradually, if you practice these meditations, preferably on a daily basis, your brain begins to rewire itself so that you become, you know, progressively happier, more clear-sighted, and many of your kind of troubles just tend to fall away by the wayside. So you end up with becoming, you know, overall far happier and more effective in whatever you're doing.
A lot of people confuse the idea of meditation as something religious or, you know, linked to Buddhism. The exercises that you're speaking about are completely secular, right? It's
Absolutely. I mean, the early Buddhists were the ones who, I suppose, codified meditation, mindfulness. And obviously they had a religious perspective, but the practice itself is not even remotely religious. And, you know, it is present in all religions, actually, and also, you know, atheists are perfectly happy to practice mindfulness because it cultivates this great clarity of thought. You know, if you're sitting watching somebody meditate, you could confuse them with somebody who was praying, for example. Mm-hmm. However, that's just a surface appearance. It's nothing to do with religion at all. That doesn't preclude religious people from meditating. It's just the practice itself is not religious.
So in the book that you co-wrote with Vijayamala Birch, one significant difference that I notice in this book from the from your earlier book, in fact, the book that we focus on in our first podcast, is there is a more in depth around the science the benefits for meditation. Yeah. Perhaps you can comment on what some of those benefits are.
Yeah, I mean, the first book, Mindfulness, Finding Peace in the Frantic World, was really focusing on kind of mental pain and suffering. And the second book, which was Mindfulness for Health, is focused mostly on physical pain and suffering. Because the odd thing with mindfulness is it's absolutely brilliant at dissolving chronic physical pain. And, in order to... That's a big hill to climb for a lot of people. Most people can understand that meditation is good for your kind of mental health and well-being, but it's a huge step for most people to think actually it's good for physical pain or suffering. It works largely by dissolving stress, it works on two levels. One is dissolving stress, because physical stress actually aggravates the sensations of physical pain. On a very simple level, if you're extremely tense and you have something like arthritis, for example, the actual extra tension will kind of, in a way, grind together the joints a little bit more. It will enhance the physical problems associated with pain, which then feeds back and generates more physical pain. But by dissolving kind of mental anxiety, stress, and depression, mindfulness actually turns down the thermostat, the brain's thermostat on pain, the gain control or the amplifiers in the brain that actually conjure up the sensations of physical pain. Because pain is, it's called a sensation for a reason, in that actually it's an interpretation. You have this kind of raw, if you have an injury, for example, you have this raw data that's being sent from the site of the injury through to the brain, and that actually turns that into the sensations of pain. And because it's a mental construct, as it were, that means you can gain a measure of control over it, and that ultimately you can turn down the pain amplifiers in the brain. Now, that's not to say that physical pain isn't real. I mean, if you've ever been in pain, you will know it is absolutely real. But it's just a way of visualizing how you can control your pain more effectively through mindfulness.
And one fact that fascinated me was that, in learning this, is that the brain is a muscle and it can grow.
Yeah, absolutely. If you forever focus on the negative, then you reinforce the brain circuits that are always looking out for negative events, as it were. And if you tend to focus on the positive, I don't mean that, in this kind of stupid Pollyanna attitude where you're always trying to make yourself happy. But if you actually just notice the good things in life, then you tend to reinforce reinforce the brain, parts of the brain that look out for the good parts of life. Because strange as it seems, it takes five positive things to outweigh a single negative thing of equal magnitude. It's called the negativity bias, because evolution has forced us to always look out for the negative, to always look on the bleak side of life. And it does this for a very good reason, that danger and threats could potentially kill you extremely quickly if you're living in on the African savannah a million years ago, for example. So your brain is being fine-tuned by evolution to focus with laser sharpness on danger and on risk, and that obviously means that you could develop anxiety and stress problems. Now, in practice, for each negative situation you find yourself in, you actually need five positive ones to outweigh it or to balance it. So mindfulness gives you the opportunity to kind of realize that at a real deep and visceral level, and see how you always focus on the negative, always focus on the dangers and risks of life, even if they're not real, even if they're imaginary, or even if it's just a stressful situation. Mm-hmm. And once you see that and how your brain latches onto the negative with ease and how it constantly fails to notice the positive, you progressively rebalance your brain. You rebalance your approach to the world. And this has a curious effect. It actually allows you to make decisions more effectively, and also it enhances creativity and problem solving, because you're less worried about taking risks, about following thoughts and ideas wherever they should lead. And this kind of enhanced clarity of awareness is hugely important, not just for day-to-day happiness, but also grasping every opportunity that comes your way. And that's kind of what my third mindfulness book is about. It's called Mindfulness for Creativity, because it allows you to, or it helps you enhance your own creativity and clarity of thought and problem solving.
And when is this book due to be released?
October the 1st. So it's very soon, literally 2 months away. The focus of the new book, Mindfulness for Creativity, is focused with laser sharpness on enhancing creativity.
They mentioned that creativity can only take place in the present moment.
Yes.
Now, when I first heard that was a really interesting statement for me. Well, what does that mean, being in the present moment? And it's through mindfulness techniques and meditation that allows you to be in that present moment where you're not focused about the past, nor are you, worried about events in the future, yeah. But you're in the present moment. It sounds very easy to do. And I think for me, that's been one of the key benefits of my daily practice of meditation, to have these tools that when my mind starts to wander, I can, use my breath as the anchor and come back to the present moment. And it's within this present moment that they say the creativity is allowed to take place.
Yes, yes. I mean, it's become apparent over the last 2 or 3 years that mindfulness not only helps with kind of mental and physical pain and suffering, it creates or enhances creativity and decision-making and problem-solving. And it does this largely by dissolving stress and anxiety. So it kind of creates this playful space, as it were, mm-hmm. in the present moment, where you're just not worrying about the outcome. And there's nothing kills creativity more than worrying about the outcome.
Yes.
Because, creativity is kind of an end in itself. If you're trying to direct it too much, or even encouraging it with a little too much gusto, you kill it, basically. You need a playful space. You ask anybody, whether it's an artist, a writer, a scientist, an engineer, anybody who relies on creativity will tell you they get their ideas really, really odd times when they're totally relaxed. It's when they're getting a shower or walking to the pub, or these situations where you just let your guard down and you just relax into whatever you're doing. Mm-hmm. Those moments are when creativity really happens, and that's what mindfulness does, in a sense. And the course in the new book, Mindfulness for Creativity, it's a really simple 4-week course. So, anybody can do it. It's 10 to 20 minutes a day, and it focuses mostly on a type of meditation known as open monitoring. And these are mindfulness meditations that go back thousands of years. But they're called open monitoring because they kind of broaden your field of awareness, as it were. So it allows you to encompass more information, more ideas, and hold them in this kind of big, open, playful space. And then your brain, just ticking away in the background, just puts these ideas together and creates something new and helps you make decisions more effectively.
Wow. I mean, are they similar? Because the exercises that that are repeated in the Mindfulness for Health,
yeah,
they are is ones that basically that I use all the time, and that's the body scan meditation, and also the using the breath as an anchor.
Yes. Neither, certainly the body scan isn't in the new one. All mindfulness courses have essentially core elements to them. One is obviously is focusing on the breath, and that's very much a part of the program. After that, it focuses mostly on these open monitoring meditations, which are very, very simple to do. I mean, the simplest open monitoring meditation of all is to go to the park and meditate on a park bench so that you're surrounded by sound, and you just focus on the sound around you. And that broadens the mind, broadens the field of awareness, and progressively over the weeks, you actually become more creative. It sounds very simple. It sounds an odd thing to meditate on, but it's remarkably effective. And the other key open monitoring meditation is actually one of the old ones as well, where it directly cultivates this open monitoring state. And it's called the insight meditation. Mm-hmm. And that is remarkably effective. But you need to lay the groundwork using these other meditations first. Grounding yourself in your body, as it were, using the body scan is a core element of all meditation programs. And although there is no direct body scan meditation in the Mindfulness for Creativity program, there is... the start of all the meditations incorporates just a minute or so of actually focusing on the body. So there is that element to it, but it's not a core element.
Danny, when we last spoke, I hadn't meditated. I was kind of getting into the idea of mindfulness through my co-host, Anne. Okay. He'd mentioned mindfulness, and so we were lining up interviews with specialists in this area. But since then, I have, meditated almost every day. And I say almost quite loosely, about at least five times a week.
That's good. Yeah. That's very good, actually. Five times a week is all anybody can ask for, really.
Yeah. And what I noticed was how little control I have over my thoughts.
Yes.
And I think that was the first kind of groundbreaking, aha moment. Where we live our lives thinking that we have so much control and that we are, 100% linked to the thoughts and the voices in our heads.
Yeah.
But when you try and, what I love about the mindfulness exercises, I don't even refer to them as a meditation. I call them a brain exercise because they're so simple.
Yeah.
But yet just sitting down and trying to focus on your breath for even a minute, for me, was so challenging.
Oh, yes.
And it just highlighted what goes on constantly in my mind all the time.
Yes. I mean, you don't have any control over the thoughts that appear in your mind in the short term, but you have a choice over how you react to them. So you have conscious control, but that doesn't mean you can control your thoughts. Ultimately, the state of mind that you spend most of your time in does begin to guide your thoughts, which is one of the problems with depression, of course, is that people get locked into these downward spirals. And so where one negative thought triggers the next and the next and the next. So even an initially innocuous negative thought, as it were, can trigger this whole cascade that ends up ruining an entire day, and then a week, and then a month. And in the worst cases, this can go on for years, and there is an equal and opposite situation, which is what mindfulness tends to cultivate, is by dissolving anxiety, stress, and the immediate causes of unhappiness, you enter a positive spiral. So that, you end up with more positive thoughts appearing in your mind. And So this ends up making a slightly better day, and then hopefully a more positive week, and then months, and hopefully years. And, you know, this doesn't mean you're going to end up in some ludicrous, forever happy, forever smiling state. It just means that you're more likely to respond positively to situations and to have more positive thoughts appearing in your mind. The advantage of that is it gives you, it allows you to grasp opportunities, to make the most of life. So you don't end up, as I said, in this ludicrously perennially happy state. You end up in a state which gives you opportunities, and those opportunities tend to, in the long run, make you happier, healthier, and wiser.
Right. Well, can you explain what the difference is between primary and secondary suffering? I just wanted to ask that question because, you know, from reading the book, it seems that people kind of confuse those and, you know, link them together as if they were one, where in fact they are quite different.
Yes, yes. I mean, that relates mostly to kind of physical pain and suffering, but it does reflect into kind of mental pain and suffering. But primary suffering is the initial kind of injury, as it were. So, for example, if you break your leg, and
while flying in the Cotswolds,
exactly. if you have a terrible, you know, any kind of injury, really, whether it's a broken leg or a stubbed toe, the first thing that happens is, from the sight of the injury, you get all of this signals, pain signals that flood your brain. So they're sent from the sight of the injury to your brain, and that is primary suffering. And on top of that, your brain then interprets that data and, in a sense, gives it meaning. And that's secondary suffering. Now, you can't do anything about primary suffering if you've just broken your leg, but you can do an immense amount you have an immense control over secondary suffering, because this is all of the anxiety, stresses and worries and unhappinesses that are triggered by the initial primary suffering. And it's thoughts like, I've broken my leg. Am I going to lose my leg? Are they going to chop it off? And will I ever be able to walk again?
Right.
I've got weeks off work. I've got months off work. I might lose my house. Mm-hmm. My wife might leave me, or my husband might leave me. And all of those tend to enhance the physical side of pain, because pain is made up of primary and secondary suffering. So if you can actually progressively dissolve secondary suffering, you manage to get rid of a huge amount of the overall pain that you feel. And this has been proven in laboratory studies now. People who practice mindfulness meditation can get rid of roughly half of the intensity of the physical pain that they're suffering, which is an astonishing figure. You know, if somebody's in pain and you said to them, I can remove 50% of that intensity, they would just bite your hand off, because it's the difference between being completely incapacitated and being able to cope. Now, long-term meditators can get rid of over 90% of the physical pain and suffering, which takes it from, again, being incapable of living with the pain through to something that they barely notice, which for anybody who has physical pain is an immense achievement. You know, they wouldn't just bite your hand off, they'd bite your legs and arms off as well.
Yes, yeah.
You know, and this has been proven in laboratory studies, and it is now being investigated by our book is being used in pain clinics across the UK and investigated because it seems to be extremely effective.
Yes, well, speaking of the science, I've opened your book to the science bit, and I just wanted to read off some of these, you know, some of the benefits that mindfulness meditation can bring, you know, backed by science. It says, including multiple sclerosis and cancer, improves memory, creativity, attention, improves emotional intelligence, is as good as drugs or counselling for the treatment of clinical depression. You know, something we touched upon in our last podcast, Danny, that, about 10% of people clinically depressed. You know, it's some scary figures here. It reduces addictive and self-destructive behavior, increases gray matter in areas associated with self-awareness, empathy, self-control, and attention.
Yeah.
Improves the immune system. And one that I found fascinating, can help to reduce aging at the cellular level by promoting chromosomal health and resilience.
I know, that is remarkable findings. It's been backed up by a couple of other studies. I initially wanted to downplay that because although the initial studies were, you know, gave really strong results, I was thinking, surely this can't be true. But similar findings have been found by a couple of other studies. And this isn't going to wind back the clock, I presume, but what seems to be happening, one of the main measures of aging is actually the what they call the telomeres. Let me explain. At the end of each chromosome in the cells, the body's cells, there's these caps that protect the end of the chromosomes themselves.
Yes.
And what happens is, over time, as the years and decades pass, these become eroded, as it were.
Mm-hmm.
And that in turn governs how many times a cell can divide before it eventually ends up what they call senescent.
Yeah.
And essentially, if your body cells can no longer divide, you begin to wear out. And that's just a good way of looking at it. You begin to wear out, which is what aging is, you know.
Mm-hmm.
As more and more cells in the body enter this senescent state, you can no longer repair yourself. What seems to happen is the telomeres seem to begin to grow back, which is an extraordinary finding because, at least according to the accepted model of aging, you become biologically younger.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's difficult to see how a 50-year-old can suddenly become physically a 20-year-old, for example. Yeah. But it does imply that this can slow down
aging. Right, the slowing down of the aging process. Yes, yeah.
Exactly. And it may be that stress accelerates aging, and what mindfulness does is, by dissolving or reducing stress,
mm-hmm.
it actually slows down the aging process. I don't know. I don't think anybody knows. I think this is a really exciting area because, you know, in 5 or 10 years, if studies confirm this, then maybe we can start drawing some conclusions that mindfulness slows down aging or halts aging in some way. Don't know. I don't know what the answer is.
No, but I mean, I heard it on the Joe Rogan podcast, his guest, Dr. Rhonda Patrick, and she was explaining, you know, about the telomeres.
Oh, telomeres, yeah.
Yeah, the telomeres.
Yeah.
And the way I heard it described was, you know, like the plastic bits at the end of a shoelace.
Mm.
The way she describes it. And as the cell recreates an identical copy of itself, yes. these telomeres, they slightly shorten in length.
That's right, yes.
At each reproduction, very slightly, yeah. but throughout the course of someone's lifetime towards the end, you know, as the aging process really starts to kick in, it's one yes. of the reasons they say for that is the shortening of length.
Yeah.
Absolutely fascinating, and just another positive thing on the list of the benefits of meditation.
Yeah. Yes, absolutely. And I would want to stress that, you know, in the book I mentioned that it's mindfulness is very good for people suffering from cancer. That doesn't mean it's a cure for cancer.
Right.
It helps people cope more effectively with the diagnosis. And also it helps with the anxiety and stress that people will inevitably feel if they should develop cancer or be diagnosed with cancer.
Yeah.
Now, that in turn will enhance the immune system because stress undermines the immune system and mindfulness has been shown to enhance the immune system. So there are almost certainly physical benefits, but it's not like you know, you've got a terminal diagnosis and this is going to cure you. It's, but it, you know, it is going to help, I would say. It's not a substitute for chemotherapy or radiotherapy or anything like that, but it can certainly enhance quality of life and may have other benefits too.
Right. I believe mindfulness can help to bring about happiness on all levels. And since partnering up with the Action for Happiness, there's 10 keys to happier living. It's something that, you know, I see posted up at some of their all of their events. It's something that you can find on their website. It's a template. It's an acronym of how to live a happy life. And so the 10 keys, it spells out great dream. And I just wanted to read them out because as I go to these events and I see this great dream spelled out and explained, I can't help but feel that mindfulness meditation can help in all of these areas. So if you could quickly read them out. So it's the great dream, 10 keys to happier living. The first one, giving, so doing things for others, relating, connecting with people, exercising, taking care of your body, appreciating, noticing the world around, trying out, so keep learning new things. Direction, have goals to look forward to, resilience, find ways to bounce back, emotion, take a positive approach, acceptance, being comfortable with who you are, and meaning, being part of something bigger.
Yes, I mean, to me, all of those things can be enhanced or helped by mindfulness. You said before, you asked, is mindfulness kind of religious or spiritual in any way? Well, I think on one level, mindfulness can enhance spirituality on the broadest level. I don't mean on a religious level. I mean just giving life some meaning or understanding that your life actually has meaning. Because that meaning comes about through kind of the networks of people in your life. And, if that's not spiritual, I don't know what is, I mean, these are all very kind of nebulous concepts. I think that's the trouble with spirituality. It's become so entwined with religion, and actually it's really just having meaning in your life. And I think that mindfulness helps you understand the connections that you have with other people and with the world in general, and that it does enhance spirituality and give you meaning in life.
Yeah, and I find it quite funny that the books on spirituality are right next to the books on self-help.
Yes.
And that a lot of the books are kind of, are in between the two.
Yes, exactly. I think the whole concept of kind of spirituality has become so, polluted really over the years that it's a word I'm always quite wary to use because it's got so much baggage attached to it. If you mention spirituality, most people, the first thing they think of is, crystal balls and waving incense around or whatever. And of course it's not, we are spiritual beings. It doesn't mean we're religious. It just means that, we are connected. Clearly mindfulness can help with that. But it can also help with, mentioned physical exercise, keep realizing your body needs physical exercise and how far you can push yourself each day and when you need to relax. Mindfulness can help with that. Basically everything on that list.
Exactly. No, yeah. I just wanted to run it by you. Yep, I've got the check. So I mentioned that the Dalai Lama, His Holiness, is speaking at our event on the 21st of September. He's coming with Daniel Goleman, Mathieu Ricard. There's going to be a whole host of people speaking that day. But just given your work, Danny, in this field and your and the books that you've written with, the research you've done, if you could ask the Dalai Lama one question, what would that be?
Do you know what? It would probably be a slightly, it might almost be an offensive question because it's just, I want to know. Is Buddhism a religion or a philosophy? That's, to me, that's, it's got nothing to do with I don't know, spirituality or anything. But that's the question I would like answered, because to my mind, Buddhism is, I think it's a philosophy. Or it could be considered a religion without a god, as it were. Mm-hmm. Because most of the aspects of Buddhism, because obviously I'm not a Buddhist, otherwise, yeah, I certainly wouldn't be asking that question if I was.
Yeah.
But most of the aspects of Buddhism that I know seem to relate mostly to how to live your life. It's a philosophy, and it's got a lot in common with ancient Greek philosophy as well.
Yeah.
And it would be interesting if Christianity and Islam hadn't arisen, whether ancient Greek philosophy would have been codified and turned into a religion. You know, whether, you know, Plato and Socrates were kind of laying the foundations for Western Buddhism, as it were.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's what I would ask you.
Oh, brilliant.
I'm sure there's probably far more interesting questions about the meaning of life, the universe and everything, but that's what I'd like to ask.
Yeah, well, where do you see this movement going, and where do you see mindfulness in 5 years' time?
I don't know about 5 years' time, but maybe 10 or perhaps 20. I don't think we'll even notice it. I think it'll be such a part of our lives, these ideas, that we just won't even notice it. It's just like we don't notice brushing our teeth. It's just part of the background, which I think would be a huge victory, and it would be a huge step forward for kind of mental health. You know, if everybody could just several times a day tap into the world around them and what was going on in their mind, just by focusing on the breath for a few moments several times a day, and then would maybe meditate for 10 or 20 minutes at the start or the end of each day, that would transform mental health, and it would transform the world as well. And that's what I'd like to see. You know, people wouldn't even notice. It would just be such a part of the background that they just wouldn't notice. It would just be what you do each day.
Yeah.
And they will look back on our present world and think, my God, these people were going mad. They were driving themselves to fucking ruin. Didn't they realize all they needed to do was just focus on the breath for a few minutes a day?
Yeah.
And, you know, look, you know, they were working 40, 50, 60 hours a day. They were driving themselves to the edge of oblivion through overwork and through not being connected with their friends and families and wider society. And they were wrecking the environment and polluting their bodies with junk food. What was up with these people? Why couldn't they just see what they needed to do? That's the world I'm hoping will be around in 10, 20, 30 years.
Well, do you feel you have more of an obligation, you know, to help take this movement forward, just given the success of your books? And I saw an old article, a couple of years old, but books translated into 18 different languages, and, you know, over 100,000 copies sold in the UK, and that's quite an old stat.
Yeah. I mean, it's now 25, 26 languages, something like that. And we've passed 500,000 copies now, and it's still selling over 10,000 copies a month. So it's really doing quite well. And the irony is, when I originally proposed the idea of writing the book to Mark Williams, it was just a book that I thought just needed to be written, and I thought, in my bones I could feel its potential. So I'm kind of a weird mixture of an idealist and a pragmatist. I always have these lofty ideas and then try to put them in action without any real hope of success. But I just think you have to do things because they need to be done. And that's the way I approach this book, you know? And it succeeded beyond my wildest dreams.
And how has it changed your life? And, you know, do you get recognised more now?
My name does. I mean, the great thing about being a writer is not many people see your face. So they might know my name, but they won't know my face. So I'm perfectly safe walking down the street, let's put it that way. You know, it's one of those things I don't think even my neighbours know that I've written a book that I know they've read. Because they just know me as Danny.
So how can people get their hands on your books, and how can they find out more about you?
They can go to franticworld.com, the website, which explains in a little more detail all of the background to mindfulness and all three books. There's free meditations they can download, and they'll be there forever in a day.
That's on the resources section of your website.
That's right, yes. There's quite a few meditations that people can download and give it a try. I mean, obviously, I'd love them to buy the book, and it would help their practice, because I think understanding the underpinnings of mindfulness and how it actually works, I think, is crucial to helping you maintain your practice and to get the most benefit from it. So yeah, it would be great if people followed the course in any of the books, really.
Well, the good thing about your books is you include a CD with guided meditations.
Yes. I mean, all of the books contain a guided program, and I think that's what sets it apart from most other books out there. Is most other books will go on about how wonderful mindfulness is, which of course is true, and then they will give written meditations, but they will rarely give a complete course. And without the audio meditations, it's I wouldn't say it's useless, but most people will not maintain that practice.
Follow Danny on Twitter at Dr. Danny Penman. Are you on Facebook as well?
I am, and if you type in mindfulness finding peace in a frantic world, it should pop up somewhere on Facebook, at least. If you type that in on Facebook, it'll pop up somewhere.
Right, do you still meditate every day?
Most days. I usually about 5 or 6 days a week. The minimum I try to do is 20 minutes. I try to do 40, so 20 minutes at the either end of the day. But really, people can gain immense benefit from just sitting down for 10 minutes a day. I think setting the bar high is a mistake. I think if you aim to do 10 minutes a day, it will dramatically improve your life. We can't all be Buddhist monks and sit there for 3 or 4 hours a day. I mean, that would be great if you could do it, but who has the time in reality?
Well, thank you very much for all the work that you've done in helping to spread the message of mindfulness. I guess the investigative journalist in you, all those skills combined together to make there's a collection of wonderful books that, help me in my journey.
That's all right. Anybody who wants to, get these messages out there, because the world needs it. Individuals need it for themselves, but the world also needs it, I think. And I just think that if people have a little bit more time for themselves and for each other, then without sounding hopelessly idealistic, I think this could just transform the world, transform education, just giving kids a few minutes at the end of each lesson to practice a very simple meditation. If you can persuade them to do it, that would transform behavior, transform learning and creativity. And I just think that everybody needs to try this and see the benefits for themselves.
All right, well, I'll put links up to your website on how people can get a copy of your books. I'll put it all online. And for the listeners, if you've enjoyed this podcast, please visit actionforhappiness.org. And if you've enjoyed the content and you want to help out, there's a donate button there to help the work that these guys are doing. And again, 21st of September, His Holiness the Dalai Lama, Matthieu Ricard, Daniel Goleman, to name but a few, will be speaking at our event, and we'd love to see you all there. All right, thank you very much, Danny.
Brilliant, thanks.
Some of the smartest dummies can't read the language of Egyptian mummies on a fly go a moon, and can't find food for the starving tummies. Pay no mind to the youths, cause it's not like the future depends on it. We save the animals in the zoo, cause the chimpanzee them a make big money. This is how the media pillages, on TV the picture is savages and villages, and the scientists still can't explain the pyramids. Evangelists making a living on the videos of ribs of the little kids, stereotyping the image of the images, and this is what the image is. You buy a car, key pants, and all of a sudden you are say a Indiana Jones. And I take all the gold and take all the scrolls and even the bird bones. Some of the worst paparazzi I've ever seen and ever known. Put the words on this place that the world can see, and that's all that will ever show. So the ones in the west will never move east and feel like it'll be at home. Get tricked by the beast, but the way them gonna flee when the monster is fully grown. Salamonic lineage where them still can't defeat and them coulda never clone. My spiritual DNA that prints in my soul and I will forever own, Lord.